Well, I was born in Bridgeport.
Yeah.
I grew up in the east side of Bridgeport. I went to St. Charles School and graduated from there. I think, go back. I see if my arithmetic's pretty good. 1937.
Uh-huh.
And then I went to Harding High School, and I graduated from Harding in 1941. And then the next.
So what year were you born?
1924.
24.
Yeah.
Okay. And tell me a little bit about your mother and father.
Well, my father was from New York. He came to Bridgeport after he got out of college. And this is where he met my mother, where they got married, and my father, they stayed there.
And what was his job?
He was an accountant in Bridgeport. Don't ask me the name of the company because I don't recollect, but because he died very young. My father was 42 when he, because I was 8 years old.
You were 8.
So, and my mother brought the four of us up, and after high school, my older brother went to, he was at Catholic U, and then he went to service, and then I followed him.
Yeah, it must have been hard for your mother.
Well, it was tough because it was, the Depression era, and she had four children to support.
Mm-hmm.
So, but somehow she got by with it, scraping her pennies together. And
what kind of person was she? Tell me a little bit about your mother.
Well, she was a very strong-willed woman. I mean, she had to be to survive, that's, she was able to handle all four of us and still work. She had herself a job, and if she didn't have a job, we wouldn't have made it.
Where was she working, do you remember?
For a while, she worked for the government. During the Depression, they used to have these stations around the city where people would go once a week, and they would get a box of food, staples of all sorts to keep them going, and my mother ran one of those. And then she went to work for the Remington. The war was approaching, and she worked at Remington Arms until she retired. But,
what was her name?
Hmm?
Her name?
Her name was Ennis. Mary Elizabeth Ennis was my mother's name.
Uh-huh. And your father's name?
My father's name was Hugh Curran. So.
And do you have vivid memories of your father since he died so young when you were sitting?
Not that much, because as I say, I was about 8 years old. The number one memory I have of my mother and father are the two of them walking home from church on a Saturday evening. They would go up to church and go to confession. They were Catholics, of course, and she would, the two of them, this is the most vivid memory I have of the two of them coming down the street together.
Mm-hmm.
But, that after I graduated from high school, and of course I went into service too.
I don't want to go there yet,
okay.
If you don't mind.
I want to really get some
of your personal memories from the East Side and what life was like. That's why I was asking you about your mother. Do you remember the day your father died? Do you have a memory of that?
Yeah, I do, because of one incident that occurred. It was All Saints Day, and the hospital called my mother, evidently, to come up to the hospital. And my older brother and I took the younger two to church, because it was a holy day, and we had to go to church.
Mm-hmm.
I remember my mother telling us to go to church and say a prayer for my father.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened. And we come home, and this is when we found out he had died.
Mm-hmm. What did he die of?
An acute form of tuberculosis I don't know what it really was. It's just that many years later, on his death certificate, I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's, when it happened, you're young, you don't understand any of that stuff.
Okay.
So that type of thing was prevalent in those days.
When you say your mother was a strong-willed woman, can you give me a story that would illustrate that? Give me an example.
I don't know, except there's just to say that, you know, she realized that she had to take care of the four of us, and that meant that she had to find some kind of employment, because she wasn't working prior to that. She had to find employment, and she had to make sure that she managed her nickels and dimes, because people didn't make any money in those days, but her nickels and dimes, so that we could live where we lived. It was actually had originally been my grandfather's house, and it was left to my mother.
Well, the house was.
But you know, she had to pay the taxes and the insurance and everything else that went with it. Mm-hmm. So the strength of her character is what stands out most in my mind.
Mm-hmm. And what was the house itself like?
It was a typical maybe 6 or 7 rooms house. You know,
Victorian?
Not Victorian, but it was contemporary for those days. I don't know whether I don't think you'd call it colonial, but it probably was. But it was the type of house you would see on the east side of Bridgeport in those days. Uh-huh. Single family house.
So what was life like on the east side?
We lived in a kind of a mixed neighborhood. The neighborhood, maybe in my mother's younger days, was Irish, but it had changed. And now it was a mixture, predominantly Italian. There was a few Irish, and there was a lot of Polish and Russian people in the neighborhood. Yeah, I had a lot of friends that were Italian that I went to school with and that are still my friends today.
Uh-huh. Were a lot of people were poor in that neighborhood?
Everybody was poor. Everybody, but nobody knew they were poor, you know. It's everybody was had to scrape their pennies together to get by. People were religious. I mean, they went to their own church, whether it was a Polish church or the Irish church or the Italian, this is where they went. A lot of the kids went to St. Charles School because that was the Catholic school in the neighborhood.
Uh-huh. And you went to?
I went to St. Charles.
And what were, they were nuns teaching?
They were nuns, yeah.
Yeah, what were they like?
They were disciplinarians, you know, you had to toe the mark. They were able to manage large classes. They'd have 35 kids in a class today, they'd be shocked. But, you know, it was a disciplined environment, and they were able to handle the job.
Do you remember any in particular who stand out, any of those nuns?
Not really. I just, you know, you remember them. No one face sticks out that you recognize or remember. They just were. When you went to school class, you went to class. I mean, if you fooled around, the next thing you know, your parents had a little note that you weren't behaving. And, that would then you'd be in real trouble.
Mm-hmm. What did you do for fun as a kid?
The kids in those days, there was no Little League or anything like that. It was sandlot stuff. That whether it was football or baseball, you know, whatever. Played in the streets because there wasn't a lot of traffic in those days. And, but it was, you know, as you got a little older, you probably got into more organized things like the Holy Name Leagues and stuff like that, where you'd be playing different kids in different neighborhoods. But generally, when you were younger, it was strictly sandlot, so pickup games and stuff of that sort.
And were there tensions between the Irish and the Italians?
Not really.
No.
I don't think.
Not that you remember.
It's not my recollection, no.
Okay.
Because as I say, I've got a lot of friends that are, that I still run into occasionally that came from the Arab neighborhood.
Okay. And I know, so now, do you remember December 7th, 1941, where you were when you?
I think it was a Sunday, and I think I was in a bowling alley, or a bowling. alleys, the Boston alleys were up on Boston Avenue, and that's where I recollect that that's where I was. Yeah.
And how did the war change your life?
Well, the war changed my life because at that point in time, I went in the service. Maybe 6 or 8 months afterward, in the fall, the following year. But it changed my life because it guaranteed me a college education that I'm not sure I would have gotten. My mother couldn't afford to send me to college. My brother was in college, but he was there on a scholarship.
So, can you tell me about your war experiences, but in a more, if you could slow it down a little, and, you know, the whole point of this is it's like your life story.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, I went to the induction center. This is what so-and-so said to me. You know, I'm jumping around because I don't know what it is that you would prefer, what you consider to be.
You do whatever you want. I mean,
but
so
let's slow it down.
I'm just here for the ride.
Okay. So tell me some of your memories from the war in a more sustained way.
Well.
Like, what made you, you know, and then the day you went in.
Well, my brother was a paratrooper, and I wanted to go in the Air Force, and my mother wasn't too happy about it, but my brother said, well, he's going to go anyway, so you know, you might as well let him go where he wants to go. So I became an aviation cadet in the Air Force. Then it was the Army Air Force, Air Corps, rather. It wasn't a separate branch of the service. But so that when you went in the Army, you had to go through basic training, and then from basic training, you would go to aviation cadet through that program. So, you had to take a lot of aptitude tests. And from that, they would determine where you should go, what you should do, what your background, you know, what your capabilities were. And I remember being interviewed by an officer who told me I had a natural aptitude for mathematics. Well, I didn't, for you and I didn't believe him. And I should be a navigator. And I told him I wasn't interested in being a navigator. I wanted to be a pilot. And whatever happened, they sent me to flying school, so I did become a pilot.
Uh-huh.
And then when I got through with flying school, and I was assigned to the fighters, and then I went to Europe, and I was in the Ninth Air Force, and we went all the way across Europe into Germany. We were the first fighter group to land in Germany. We occupied a Luftwaffe training field on just across the Rhine River. We were the first air group that went in there. And we were there till the end of the war. I was over there for about 4 or 5 months maybe after the war. And I stayed behind. The air group that I was in came back to the United States, and they went to Colorado to check out in jets, because we didn't have jets in Europe. Mm-hmm. And I stayed behind and was transferred to another outfit, and I stayed there till the end of September, beginning of October. In the meantime, they came back home. Mm-hmm. They went to Colorado. VJ Day came, and they all were discharged. I'm still in Europe at that point in time, and I was supposed to come back home, and then I was going to be a flight instructor. And I came back home, and the war was over, and I went to college.
Anything that stand out from that time in Germany? I mean, any incidents or, you know, dramatic events? Or let's say somebody's listening.
Well, you're in a shooting war. Everything's dramatic.
Tell me about one of the.
Are, people you're getting shot at all, every time you go into enemy territory. I mean, you're not their buddy, you're not their friend, they're out to kill you, and they were shooting at you. Fortunately, I survived. Two times, came back with the plane all shot up, but I was fortunate I didn't have a scratch.
So you came back and went to college. Where did you go to college?
I went to Holy Cross to college. Mm-hmm. And that was like I was in college within a couple of weeks of landing in the United States. Uh-huh. And, I went there for 3 years. And instead of graduating, which I probably, in hindsight, I should have done, I applied to go to law school. Because at that time in Connecticut, you could become a lawyer without a four-year college degree. Mm-hmm. And I went to Boston College to law school and graduated from there and started practicing in Bridgeport. Got myself into politics.
How did you get yourself into politics?
Well, it was really accidental. I got a visit one day from a gentleman by the name of Cornelius Mulvihill, and he was a Democratic leader in Bridgeport and in this part of Connecticut. And he came to me, and he wanted me to run for alderman in Bridgeport. And at that time, Jasper McLeavy was really still in his prime, and he was doing pretty good. And he told me, he says, "You can't win, but I think you ought to run." And I went home, and I was living home then because I was not married. And I remember my folks telling me that, he won't steer you wrong. And I'm just a fledgling young lawyer struggling at that point in time. And he said, "He won't steer you wrong. You ought to do what he asks you to do." So I did, and I did get beat. But the times were changing. That you could tell that McLeavy was beginning. It was really on the beginning of his decline, and I didn't win. But the next year, I ran for the legislature, and I got elected. But then after that, I ran to be a state senator, and I got beat. And I got beat because that was the year that Eisenhower swept everything. And I had a safe Democratic district that evidently wasn't that safe because I lost. Uh-huh. And then after that, a couple of years later, I ran for mayor. And I got elected. But in the meantime, Sam Tedesco got elected mayor. Uh-huh. And I became the city attorney in his administration. And I was the city attorney for 8 years while he was the mayor. And when he got out, he became a judge, and he left. He was a lieutenant governor, and he left. I ran for mayor, and I won. So I was there for 6 years.
So you mentioned that McLeavy was in his decline. What was McLeavy like? What are your memories of McLeavy?
I remember McLeavy as a... Well, I would describe him, he was labeled as a socialist, but in hindsight, I would describe him as an ultra-conservative. And he came along, I think, at the right time for Bridgeport, because there had been scandals, similar to what has happened now. And he came along right afterward and got himself elected, and then from then on, he was it, because he wasn't spending any money. He was doing exactly what the taxpayer wanted. He was holding the tax rate down. Mm-hmm. At some point, maybe he should have spent some money, which he didn't do. But he was good for Bridgeport. And he got Bridgeport out of a hole. And he was there for about 25 years before he lost. But the handwriting was on the wall the time before that, because Tedesco ran against him twice. Mm-hmm. The first time, he almost beat him. and he did beat him the second time. And McLevy, this was a terrible shock to McLevy, I think, that for him to lose. But, you know, he lived a few years after that. I mean, but I think that he just couldn't get over the fact that he lost. And he died. I don't think there was, and I don't want to have this come out the wrong way, I don't think there was any love lost between him and Tedesco, because Tedesco was the guy to beat him. Not because Sam was a bad guy, because he wasn't. He was a nice guy. But he felt that he's the guy to beat him, he's the bad guy, you know. I think a lot of the credit for McLevy's defeat has got to go to this gentleman by the name of Mulvihill, who was a Democratic leader. He surrounded himself with a lot of young people, including myself. He used to always say, give me young people anytime. And he says, then I can do things. And he did. Sam ran twice. He won the second time. He was elected a lieutenant governor. And Sam's administration, a lot of the second level people were all really young, in their late 20s, 30s. Maybe that's not so young today, but it was in those days. Because when I was elected mayor, I was like about 40 years old, and that was unheard of to be that young. But since then, a lot of young guys have been elected mayor younger than that. But guys like Tom Busey and people like that, were Lenny Paoletta, they were younger. Things have...
Well, why do you say that McLevy was really conservative? Because he spent no money, or what?
I think he was a fiscal conservative, yeah. He didn't want to spend money. There's no doubt about it. He was good for Bridgeport at the time. Bridgeport's financial condition was not good. But when he left office, it was a AAA, in AAA condition.
What are your memories of him when you were a kid growing up? Do you remember?
Not that much. I remember him as a guy talking on a street corner, you know, that sort of thing. I liked him as a person. I thought he was a nice guy. And he was enjoyable to sit down and have a cup of coffee with him. There was a place on Main Street in Bridgeport called Van Dyke's. This is where a lot of people used to go for a cup of coffee in the morning. He would come in there, and he had his... the same coat or suit on all the time, and the tie, and maybe there was a little few soup stains on it, that sort of thing. But he was a nice guy, and he was great for Bridgeport. I was instrumental in having the old City Hall named after him. I issued an executive order that was to henceforth to be known as McLevy Hall. It still is. And I think, in fact, I remember when Tedesco was mayor, they took down some old, from the 1800s, the late 1800s buildings, and were in tough shape. The city bought them, tore them down, and they put that little park there that's alongside of McLevy Hall, and that was called McLevy Green. So it was logical that the old City Hall be named after him. He spent 25 years in there, and there was no reason not to name it after him.
Did you know his wife?
No, I didn't.
You never met her?
I don't recollect ever meeting her. I think she kind of stayed out of politics, didn't get herself involved. They had a farm up in Washington, Connecticut. He would go up there frequently. even when he was mayor, he would. There was one afternoon a week, and I can't tell you whether it was a Tuesday or a Wednesday or whatever it was. Whatever was going on, that day was his day to go to Washington, up to his farm, up there in Litchfield.
Do you remember any of the conversations you had with him over coffee?
Not really. I mean, they were just general in nature, you know, what's going on in town, that sort of thing. I never really had that close a relationship with him. Right? The difference in our ages was until I got involved and got appointed or I was in the state legislature, or after that I got appointed city attorney. I had really no connection to McLeavy. Just my own observations and the little bit that I did afterward.
And did you and the other young people who were in city government at that time, did you have this feeling that Bridgeport needed to change and that it needed this young blood and that your vision?
I think so. But, you know, young people, when they get involved in something, they have the spirit and the drive, and they don't sit back and tell war stories. Because they don't have any to tell. And people like the city clerk had been my roommate in law school. And we were close friends. And he and I were the two that fought it out to be who was going to be the mayor after Tedesco stepped down. But to the day he died, we were close friends.
What was his name?
John Branley, his name was. In fact, the fellow that was this, the town clerk, was a fellow by the name of Bill Keller, who became postmaster. And I haven't seen him in years, and I mean years. And I ran into him at Sam Tedesco's funeral. He had been visiting his daughter here, and he saw it in the paper that Sam had died, and he came to the funeral. But he's living down in Texas. You know, some people get off into the wild blue, you know. If they something happens, they go down there. He went down there with his wife to live, and he stayed there.
Mm-hmm. So, what was your when you were city attorney? What was that like? Any memories of?
My job was to represent the city and to. Also to advise all of the various city officials as to what was legal and not legal, what they could do and couldn't do. And, I had a very enjoyable 8 years doing this. I was a lawyer, and this was my profession. And I remember when I first was appointed, I was quite young to be appointed to a job like this. I was in my 30s, early 30s, and I remember I had a meeting with Tedesco, and he said to me, there's one thing I want you to understand. If I ask you for a legal opinion on a matter, I want you to give it to me straight. Don't say what you think I want to hear, but I want you to do what you think is give me what you think is the right answer. And not something that you think might be politically astute, he said, because someday you're going to give me an answer on some minor thing, and someday something important is going to come along, and now you're stuck with that answer you gave me. And he says, from the day one, I want you to give it to me straight, the right answer. So he and I got along, we were good friends.
So what were some of the things you gave him answers on, maybe that he wanted to hear, maybe that he didn't want to hear?
No, he never questioned me. Whatever any opinion I gave him, if he wanted an opinion, he would ask me for one. And I would give it to him, and that was it.
I mean, just some examples that, if you can remember, of some of the things he was asking you for your legal advice on at the time.
I don't know, it's hard for me to remember any particular thing that he might have asked me about. It's general. It's But yeah, you're a lawyer, except you're a lawyer for the city. That's all. That's the only difference.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is how did he run the city, especially how did he run the city as a younger man, you know, coming after McLevy?
Tedesco were that Tedesco had a young outlook on things. Mm-hmm. He wanted new things. He knew that the infrastructure of the city was in tough shape because nobody spent any money on it. And so he knew that he had to spend money, whether anybody liked it or not, because the schools, he had to build schools. He had the sewers. All the things that go toward building a modern city, he had to catch up, because for 25 years, nothing happened. Which actually, it was important in the beginning, because it gave the city a chance to rebound financially. But at the end, you know, when things should have been done, they weren't done because McLevy was very frugal. Tedesco assumed office, and he realized that things have got to be done, and he started to do it. They were constantly building schools. Even through my administration, they were building schools.
And housing was a problem also? Housing shortage?
Now, you know what was a big thing that I think started with Tedesco and it went on with me was redevelopment. Because a lot of the older areas of the city were started to go. Factories, some of the older factories, they were moving out of. And the first redevelopment was Sam Tedesco did. That was that area where Housatonic Community College is now, and all in that area. Because everything was taken down around the library, south of the library, that was the first redevelopment project in Bridgeport. Uh-huh. And Tedesco, this is his commencement of trying to change everything. Those days. There was still the Central Business District was still the core of the city. This is where all the shopping went on. This is where the banking center was. The only thing left down there now is, you might say, it's a banking center. There's People's Bank is still there. Generally, the banks merged. There were failures. City Trust failed. That building is empty. Right now it's empty. Somebody just bought it, I think, and they want to convert it to some kind of multi-use, from what I read. So
what was it like in the 50s down there, downtown?
In the what?
In the 1950s.
50s?
Yeah.
Well, this is when Tedesco got elected in 1957. Mm-hmm. Downtown Bridgeport was a bustling area. You had department stores, you had banks, you had the post office, you had the court. And this was the heart of everything. Bridgeport was essentially an industrial city, so you had all kinds of factories. You had GE, Dictaphone, you had Bridgeport Brass. They're not there anymore. GE has that immense complex on the east side of Bridgeport, but it's 80% empty. The first couple of buildings, I think, are used as an overflow from its corporate headquarters. They're occupied, but I think the rest of it is empty. But in those days, those factories were still going strong, and they had moved out. A lot of the movement toward the south had started to occur. And then I think what happened was really, while I was in office, the first mall-type shopping center was built in Trumbull. And, of course, where did they go looking for their clients? They raided the nearest city. And Bridgeport lost some of its department stores, for instance. So moved to the Trumbull Shopping Center. But you know, that still there still was a lot of business in downtown Bridgeport. It's only after I got out of office that, you know, it really started to go. Mm-hmm. But we were fortunate enough to get the court system to build a new courthouse right in the middle of downtown Bridgeport. And that brings a lot of people. Maybe some people say not the right kind of people, but I kind of don't agree with them, but because it brings lawyers and witnesses and people of that sort into downtown Bridgeport that wouldn't be there normally.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little more about Tedesco. I mean, just some of your personal recollections of him, kind of person he was.
Sam was kind of a I don't want to use the word loner. Sam was the kind of guy who he wasn't I'm trying to think of the right word, but he kept to himself a lot. He was married, had a son. He's an educated guy. He was an astute lawyer and businessman. And he was a nice guy, but it was he was very private also. Now his personal life was his, and it was no one else's. He lived on the east side of Bridgeport, around the corner from where I lived, actually, where I lived at the time.
So you used to see him in the neighborhood?
No, because as I say, he was a private guy. I remember Sam long before he was mayor, because we all grew up in the same east side of Bridgeport. He lived on Rose Street. I lived down by St. Charles Church, but he lived further up, I knew him all the time. I knew his brother probably better than I knew him.
But there must be, you know, some stories that kind of illustrate what kind of person he was. Just the same way you said you would sit with McLeavy and maybe add a little soup on his tie, and that gives you a sense of what kind of person he was. What about Sam? I mean, were there occasions when, I won't lead you, you tell me. You know, a story. If you were sitting around with a bunch of your old cronies telling stories about Sam Tedesco, what would some of those stories be? Say what kind of person he was.
I don't know. I suppose things that happened, the topic of the day was really. Because I remember Sam when he went off to college. He went to, I believe it was the University of Kentucky. I'm not sure, but I think that was it. And he was one of the few guys. He was older. I mean, he died, I think he, just as they say, a few months ago. I think he was 86 or 87 years old. You know, you knew the people in the neighborhoods. They went to the church or school or something else together. So you knew people. It was a different atmosphere than it is today. To say that, you know, what went on with Sam, most of my relationship with Sam was lawyer to client kind of thing. And one politician to another. We were all involved in the same objectives. The interest was that we wanted to maintain our those objectives and to continue to build an organization. I think it's today it's a little different.
So you took to politics, obviously. You liked politics.
I enjoyed politics. Yeah. I did. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I would enjoy it today. I really don't know. Once in a while, I'll run into a friend of mine, and we'll talk about politics.
Well, what made you decide to run for mayor?
I think I have been involved closely enough when I was a city attorney to reach the conclusion that I wanted to be mayor and that I wanted to do something for the city of Bridgeport. And that precipitated the thing. My family were always very supportive of me. And so I knew that, you know, and then I got married and my wife was, whatever I wanted was okay. And my wife wasn't from Bridgeport, she was from Boston, so. But she joined in and I think we developed an organization of people and, who were concerned with the growth of Bridgeport. The same thing with Tedesco. I think Tedesco took the lead, and he had an organization. While you still had the old-time politicians, you had a lot of young people involved in different boards and agencies and stuff that he would appoint people that not young because they were young, but very often, you know, people that could do the job and do a good job. I think that's half the battle in politics today, is to get people involved that are interested and who you know are going to do the right thing.
So who were some of the people you got involved?
Well, one of them just died. I went to his funeral this weekend, Frank Verrilli, who was the town clerk for a long time. And then he became a workers' compensation commissioner. And he just died this weekend. There were people that I appointed to the various boards that, that I see all the time. I run into them here in between. Court, if there are a lot of lawyers that I know from those days, I don't know the name, an individual, it's difficult. A few of them might still be involved politically. I don't know, but you can have a lot of people involved when you're in a position that I am. This is a constant flow of people. Some of the people that I stand out most in my mind were not politicians. They weren't involved in politics, but they were involved in the city of Bridgeport. The number one individual that sticks up in my mind is Sam Hawley. Sam Hawley was the CEO of People's Bank. And he built that thing into an empire. And but he had a great interest in the city of Bridgeport was constantly concerned and ready to put his money where his mouth was. Another person that stands in my mind is the priest that was the president of Fairfield University, Father McGinnis. He was the guy who organized the number one social agency. It's called ABCD, Action for Bridgeport Community Development. He was the chairman of it. And I had I had a group of businessmen, and I tried to get the top level of all the major companies in Bridgeport, and we would meet on a regular basis, and we would have breakfast or meet after breakfast at the People's Bank boardroom. And people like Bill Simpson, who was the president of Ray Bestis, Sam Hawley, Bud Hawley, who was the chairman of Connecticut National Bank. They were two brothers. Mm-hmm. And they were both, one was chairman of People's Bank and the other was the chairman of Connecticut National. Mm-hmm. And we would meet, I had one president of the University of Bridgeport on this board. And the sole purpose of meeting was for me to get the feel the how these people felt about what was going on in Bridgeport. And give them the opportunity to, if they didn't like it, they could say it to me face to face, rather than in some country club on a golf course. They could say it to me right to my face, and it was good. It was good, very good. I don't think that happens anymore. But my purpose in doing it was to is to get the leadership of the community involved, and if they thought you should be doing something, to say so. If they thought you shouldn't be doing something, say that.
So do you remember some of the controversial decisions or some of the things that you all talked about at those meetings?
This was a regular thing that occurred all the time. So.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And tell me memories from the campaign.
Well, I don't know that, that in the big cities that you campaign that way anymore. I don't know. What I used to do, I would go take a morning, for instance, and I would go into a neighborhood. I would take whoever the Democratic leader was, whether it was an alderman, a town committee member, or what, and go ringing doorbells. And now you get all the housewives now. And, you know, if their things aren't going right, they're going to tell you. And that plus the, and I think this is a throwback to the Kennedy operation. They used to have these coffee hours. And you get your neighbors to get a neighbor to invite the surrounding neighbors to come to a coffee hour. And you just sit in somebody's living room and bat it around. And, if you do three or four of them a night, or maybe not three or four, but two or three anyway a night, you start to reach a lot of people. Ring doorbells, you reach a lot of people. I guess they still ring doorbells because somebody rang my doorbell about a week ago here in Milford. But I've never been involved in politics in Milford, so. But I think it's you've got to reach people in politics today, and we don't seem to be doing it. I think television, the radio, that stuff has taken a lot of people away from it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think you've got to spread everything around. You got to each district. You got to have people that are the nucleus of your organization. They can go out into their neighborhoods and bring more people in. Mm-hmm. And. And then you got to have an election time. You got to have an organization that's going to bring people to the polls, get them to vote, call up on the phone.
Were you surprised?
I remember when my early days, when I first began politics, getting into politics, Abe Ribicoff was running for governor. And Abe was Jewish. At that time, everybody said he can't get elected. He's Jewish, he can't make it. And they nominated him, he ran. And I can remember pouring rain election night, and a guy saying to me, "You go up on such and such a street and just ring doorbells and get the people out. If they need a ride, you give them a ride. If they, no matter what," he said, "you just go up there and go right down that street ringing doorbells." And Abe Ribicoff, I don't say that elected him because, you had the whole state of Connecticut. But he only won by about 1,500 votes that first time he ran. But, Yeah, that's the kind of spirit that I think you need. Take some guy my age now, today, who's maybe a leader, he isn't going to go ringing any doorbells. You need young people with spirit and desire to go out and do it. And I can remember pouring rain, and I was soaked to my skin when I got through. But he won. And Bridgeport, they were one of the places that he wanted. Mm-hmm. Not because of us, but I think it maybe would have happened anyway. I think they were. This was his year.
Did you admire Kennedy?
Yes. Yeah, I think the great thing about Kennedy was the involvement of young people in government. I met him on several occasions. I had a magnetism about him that I really haven't seen it since.
Mm-hmm. Now tell me about one of the times you met him.
The first time I met him, it was at a political rally in Bridgeport, and it was the Sunday before election day. And it was in downtown Bridgeport where the post office is, and the old railroad station was there. And there had to be 50,000 people there. And I'm not kidding when I say that. Kennedy came, he was like 3 hours late, and those people were still there waiting for him. Nobody left to go home. He got there. Somebody had to arrange to get his suit pressed. Not the suit he had on, but another one. He had no buttons on here. They were all gone. If you looked at his hand, his hand was swollen and all scratches on it from women grabbing him. And, he took that crowd and they had him right in the palm of his hand. And he went from there to Waterbury, and he got elected. And then from there he went back to Cape Cod, I guess, or the Mechanics Hall in Boston. And then, election day was the following Tuesday. But that I will always remember. When I met him several other times, I met him. He came to campaign in Connecticut. He landed at the Bridgeport Airport, and I met him, and this was during a Cuban Missile Crisis. And there was a group there from the Army Signal Corps, and when he landed, they plugged a red phone or whatever it is right into the airplane. And he walked out, he walked right into the crowd. And there was a guy standing with a guy that was the head of the Secret Service. And he let out one, don't put this in your view, but he was a hell of you SOB. And he says this to me, meaning Kennedy. And I said, what's the matter? I was shocked that the guy would talk about the president like that. He says, anybody can shoot him now. He says, there's nothing I can do. And he says, anybody that wants to get him can get him right now. And later on it was kind of prophetic. But they had the setup there. He was making like a symbolic tour. He was going to New Haven and up through the valley to Waterbury, where people were the original time when he ran. The people were out there at 3 o'clock in the morning waiting for him. And with the whole idea was that he was in an open touring car, but they had this helicopter. It went with the motorcade, and if anything happened, they were going to take him right out of that motorcade and take him right back to Washington. And I can remember before he came to Bridgeport a couple of times when he was a senator from Massachusetts to speak at political affairs. But, he had a magnet. He had a group around him that idolized him, and they'd do anything for him. A few times he came to Bridgeport that that he spoke. He had a way of organizing, like the political guy in his campaign was a guy by the name of John Bailey, who was the big Democratic leader in Connecticut, as you know. And but he was the guy, and in that campaign, originally did helped immensely to get him the nomination. He was able to go to people like Daley in Chicago that he knew on a personal basis, and he went. He was able to talk to all these people that he knew, and he ended up delivering a lot of delegates to Kennedy. I remember I was a delegate to that convention. It was out in L.A. when he was nominated the first time. When he had the nomination, and then they had he gave his acceptance speech in the Coliseum out there, and it was the beginning. You could tell that this thing was taking on. He was able to get Lyndon Johnson to run with him, which was cool. And, I just think that at that point, maybe because I was a young guy and you're full of vim and vigor, but it was obvious to me that he was the guy.
Uh-huh. And tell me about the day he was assassinated. Do you remember where you were? And
I was a city attorney, and I guess when he was assassinated, I came home, and my wife and I, and we went to church. Because it was such a shock that somebody would do that. And I think that generally was the feeling of everyone, was they were... They were just shocked beyond any reason that this would have happened. I think at that point he was his magnetism and his charisma were just blossoming. Suddenly, there it was. It was over.
So when you were elected in '65. In the middle of the 1960s, and things are changing, and probably lots of tensions have played themselves out in Bridgeport, too, right?
The what?
Tensions between different groups, ethnic groups. And
I don't think so. I think...
I shouldn't assume that. I
don't know what you...
I
don't know what you mean by that. I don't think...
Well, it was a turbulent decade.
There are people that they don't like you because you're Italian, or they don't like me because I'm Irish. That stuff goes on all the time. But generally, I think that Bridgeport was a melting pot, and you didn't have the same kind of thing that might go on in Greenwich, or and I'm not just picking out Greenwich for any particular reason, but Bridgeport was always a melting pot. Mm-hmm. You had all nationalities living there. I think I don't know how many different nationalities live there now, but I'll bet you it's more than what you can. Your two hands, your 10 fingers.
What were some of the challenges you faced in becoming the mayor?
Well, I think Bridgeport has always had image problems. It's a working class community, and I think the biggest problem was enhancing that image. I used to always say, you got to be proud of Bridgeport and it's what it's done, and you're part of it. And this is, to me, was most important. And got to get people to be willing to volunteer, and because there are a lot of agencies where people don't get paid anything. But the people that have the intelligence and the ability and the desire to see things done, this is part of enhancing your image. I think Bridgeport has an image problem today. I think because of the scandals that have gone on. And, I think that what it needs is, and what for the, if whoever gets elected mayor, they've got this. This is got to be one of their primary objectives, is to improve its image.
Well, what about narcotics? In the 60s, there was that, we talked about the Narcotics Commission before I turned this on.
Yeah.
Was that was a problem of narcotics?
Well, Bridgeport? I think it was beginning. I think that, yeah, there was a problem. I think marijuana was coming into popularity in those days, and hard drugs, there's no question that it was going, that it was growing, and this was a big problem. I remember going down to Washington with Sam Tedesco to speak before some, I forget whether it was the Senate or the House, some group in relation to, I was mayor then actually, and he was a judge, and he had gotten permission to go to Washington and to testify, and the two of us went together. And it's a problem. It was a problem beginning. It was beginning to blossom then, and it, you know, it's grown, and it even today. I mean, I think a lot of our crime is as a result of drugs. People become addicted, and it creates all kinds of social problems. How families break up, kids get in trouble, and the families end up closing the door in their face, which maybe that's the way you have to do it, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I think today it's a major problem.
And back then, when it was just starting, I guess it changed certain parts of the city so that even the neighborhood where you grew up, the East Side, right, began to change. Mm. Was it changing? Right?
They were changing. There's a certain evolution that goes on, and I think neighborhoods were changing, sure.
Yeah.
The neighborhood I grew up in was changing, there's no doubt about it. You know, the influence of the northern migration of the black community and the movement of the Hispanic community. It changed all of the major communities in the north. I mean, you could take and you would find, if you looked into the migration of the blacks out of the south, you would find that certain areas of the south, they migrated to the Chicago area. Others to the Pacific Coast, others to New York, and this is what's happened. Now, the Puerto Rican population, New York was the easiest point of entry. They were coming from Puerto Rico, they could fly back and forth. They're citizens, they don't have to worry about getting a visa or anything else, so there's a major influx of people from Puerto Rico. And now you're getting the Hispanics and the Southeast Asians, and they all end up in the cities, and the cities have the burden of caring for those people. That's I think a major problem that they have. Education wise, you got language barriers that you got to overcome, and so the kids that, you know, they go to school and they don't talk the major language. Somehow you got to teach them English, because I think it's more important that they learn English than you teach them in Spanish, and or whatever nationality they speak. I think the education today in the inner city is a really difficult time. Not that the kids aren't not that they don't want to learn. It's just that there's some barriers that have got to be overcome.
What about some of the Black community leaders you dealt with when you were mayor? Who were some of them?
I dealt with a lot, and now you're going to ask me their names. I can't tell you. A lot of Black religious leaders. There were some Black lawyers who later on were very good friends of mine. John Merchant, Gene Spear, they were Black lawyers that were just coming into their own. Gene has died, but John is, I think he practices down around Stanford somewhere. And you know, you got a lot of Black women that were involved in Bridgeport politics. And they were a strong part of the area. There's a Black woman, I'm telling you, her name escapes me for the moment. She was a senator. Margaret Morton, highly regarded, respected woman. She was a state senator from Bridgeport for years, and she retired. And there was another girl. She was on the Board of Education for years, and she's now, I think she holds some office in the city right now. But see, when you're away from there for 25 years, you begin to lose track of people. But you know, Bridgeport, you can't ignore the fact that it's a community diverse. You're Black, you got Hispanics, and white. None of them are a majority. So they all got to work together, or you're not going to get anywhere. And if I were to talk to the mayor today, I'd tell him he's got to get together with all these people. There's a lot of people who want to be involved, but you got to get them involved. You got to give them the opportunity to be involved.
A lot of white people were running away into the suburbs at around the time you were? There was a lot of
Not as much then as as shortly afterward. Uh-huh. I think there was a migration out of Bridgeport. Although there are still some really nice neighborhoods in Bridgeport that no one should hesitate to live in. You get the Black Rock. You got our congressman moved to Black Rock a year or two ago. Yeah. In the north end of Bridgeport and parts of the east side of Bridgeport, they have a very nice residential areas. Uh-huh. So I think it's got a lot to speak for.
And the second time you were elected, you won by a much larger margin. Were you surprised, or were you?
I knew I was going to win, but I didn't think I was going to win by that much. I recollect it was a substantial margin. But I did a lot of work. I mean, I used to be out every night in the week visiting different areas or groups or meetings or parties or whatever, you know, that and I felt it was important to be with the people, for the people to see you and be able to talk to you. Very often what happens, you get after a while you're in public life like that, you hear more complaints than you hear people patting you on the back, and then you start to avoid them, which is a mistake. I think you've got to have a group that's going to take care of those complaints, and you've got to listen to them and try to do something. If they're legitimate, if they're not, then there's nothing you can do.
And you were pretty accessible to the people?
I tried to be. I thought I was.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was important to enhance Bridgeport's image. So that I wanted the people to feel that they were proud of the fact they were living in Bridgeport. It is a blue-collar community. They're working-class people. There's no reason why they can't be proud of their city. It's like anyone else.
In those days, the Barnum Parade was still... still had it, right?
They still had the Barnum Festival. I noticed the other day, and to show you how things are changing, the black fellow was chosen to be the ringmaster next year. He's the head of a community bank in Bridgeport. So,
but what was it like in the 60s, the Barnum Festival?
I think that...
I mean, a person listening to this, by the time the person listens, maybe there will be no more. So, and it was a big parade and...
Well, they had the big parade, but they had all the other events that went on. They had the fife and drum corps competitions. They had, the dances and... it was a community time for the community to have fun, really. It was that was all. It was created by Herman Steinkraus, who was the CEO of the Bridgeport Brass Company. And that was the purpose of it, was for people to forget about their problems and have a good time for a week or so. And they had all the parades and circuses and fife and drum corps, and they a lot of good things came. They used to go to visit all the convalescent homes and the hospitals with the clowns and put on a real show for the people that couldn't get out. And I think it's lost some of its zip, I hope not. I hope I'm wrong, but because I think it's a good thing for the city. It was like a fiesta, really, was what it was. I think it's important that they continue to have it.
Seaside Park was still a very popular place when you were in there, right?
Without the parks, I think Bridgeport would have been in serious trouble. When you had after Martin Luther King was killed and you had the turmoil that went on. I think the fact that Bridgeport had two large parks where people on a summer afternoon could go and picnic or have a little pickup game of softball or things of that sort, of music and baseball game or something, I think it was like a safety valve. Beardsley Park, people from the east side could walk up there. They had a little zoo there at the time, and the baseball diamonds, and it was, a large area for people to spread out and have a picnic on a Sunday afternoon. And the same thing at Seaside Park. At Seaside Park, you had the beach. That's the only difference, really. The farsightedness of the people in the early days to create those parks. Somebody had to be thinking way ahead. And Bridgeport, was called a park city. I don't know whether you would call it that today or not, but it certainly does have two beautiful parks. Although I guess Mayor Ganim, I think he sold Beardsley Park to the state of Connecticut. And they operated as a park anyway, so it's still available to the city of Bridgeport people. And Seaside Park is, I think there's no place like it.
Did you go there as a kid?
Huh?
Did you used to go as a kid to Seaside Park?
Well, as I say, we weren't exactly... loaded with money, so we didn't. Seaside Park was quite a way to go. So I didn't. We would go down there maybe once or twice during the summer. My mother would arrange for it. We'd have a picnic kind of thing. Beardsley Park, I could walk there, and so that the kids that I hung around with, we would play ball and things of that sort. And Beardsley Park was more adjacent than Seaside Park. But then you had to, if you liked the golf, you had the golf course. Where do you get around now? Do you have a 36-hole golf course? Fairchild Wheeler. That was the Fairchild Wheeler gave the property to the city, and they built a WPA built a golf course. And it could be a championship course. They the city leased it to somebody a few years ago, and they ran it into the ground. But the city's taking it back, and the guys tell me that there's been a big improvement. Now you have 90 Acres Park. I don't know what they should do something to develop that. It's underdeveloped. The only thing there really is the Discovery Museum, and that thing is a home run, I think. Bill Simpson was the CEO of Ray Bestis. Was a prime mover behind that, and I think a lot of his people, I say his people, I mean his family and friends and whatnot, are still heavy contributors to that museum. And what happened there was Simpson was the philanthropist behind it, and they had the museum. They moved it. I forget where it was now. It was in Bridgeport, but they moved it up there. And they were having problems. And Simpson was telling the story now that very few people know, except maybe my own family. But the Simpson was the prime supporter for this museum, and he. It's really a learning museum. Kids can go up there and they can learn and things of that sort. And he came to see me, and he says to me, "I got to ask you a favor." I said, "What?" He said, "Nobody knows this, but you and I. But I've been funding that museum. I'm paying everybody's salary." And he said, "I got to the point where, I can't continue. Unless," he says, "you will give me a dollar for every public school child or student in the city of Bridgeport." And he said, "If you do that, then I will continue to do what I..." And he said, "My sister and I, and we'll raise money for the museum." I said, "Bill, I'll tell you what, I'll do you one better. I'll give you a dollar for every student in the city of Bridgeport. That means parochial and whatever, private schools. For every kid in the city of Bridgeport, I'll give you a dollar if you continue to do what support the museum." And you're the only one that I've told maybe two people that story. He came to me, and he was putting his money where his mouth was. He was a real philanthropist. He had maybe some personal problems, but other than that, he did a wonderful thing for Bridgeport. That museum still is functioning, and people come from everywhere to go there. It's great for kids. So.
You say he maybe had some personal problems.
Well, I don't. This I don't want to get him. It's nothing to do with his. Involvement with the community. I mean, he was, as I say, a philanthropist. He was the CEO at Ray Bestis Manhattan, and I say a great individual.
Mm-hmm. When Martin Luther King was assassinated, do you remember that day and concerns for?
I don't remember. I'm trying to remember where I was, but I remember going to his funeral. I went down with John Bailey and Mim Daddario, and we went in. Mim Daddario was a congressman from Hartford who later ran for governor. I ran for lieutenant governor, and we both got beat. But we went in United Aircraft's jet. We went down there, we went to the funeral, we came back the same day. I remember that.
What do you remember of this? What was it like?
Well, it was just that you arrived at the Atlanta airport, and it was an airplane to airplane. There were thousands of people there. The air was really electrified. I mean, there was a guy like Kennedy who was capturing the imagination of a lot of white people, and somebody shoots him down right in the prime of his life. I think his influence has gone on since then. But for a while there, I think that after he was killed, all hell was breaking loose. Bridgeport was fortunate. It didn't have the rioting or the destruction that other places had. I think part of that was due to its police department. I think that they maintained that order. We had the police working on 12-hour shifts, 24 hours around the clock. The chief himself was right there, visible all the time. I think it had a great effect on everyone. Bridgeport did not have the problems that the other major cities in Connecticut had. We had problems. I don't. Anybody says we didn't would be lying to you. I think the outcome of it is you're still feeling the effect of it today, where you had groups of people, instead of rioting, you had them sitting down talking to each other. And maybe they didn't talk before, but they were talking now. You had all kinds of people, bombastic, and then other people who were quiet and doing a good job. But it took all types. It brought all types together in the entire community, not just a portion of it, the political community. No, it was the entire community coming together, educators and social activists and people of that sort.
Do you remember one of those meetings? Can you tell me about one of those meetings?
Well, you would go to a meeting, and you had, as I say, a broad base, and you might get some black woman get up and give it to you right between the eyes, you know, and now you got to sit there and take it, and maybe come back and question her or challenge her that she's not right, and maybe she is right. And if so, now what are you going to do about it? This was the type of meeting that went on. And it wasn't just politicians. We brought in the same people that I'm talking about that used to attend these meetings that I had. A lot of them were involved in this, like Hawley was involved in everything. And I think he's probably the number one guy that ever came out of Bridgeport. He had his finger in everything. He was really involved in the community completely. Of course, his business was important that he be involved in the community. Because if you wanted to buy a house, you had to get a mortgage. His bank was the one that was giving you the mortgage. And he probably had programs that would allow the minority groups to get a mortgage on a home. I remember he was involved in financing some small condominium developments in different sections of Bridgeport that made it available for minority people to own their own home and things like that he was involved in. And we were fortunate that we had somebody of his character, a leader in the community, the leader maybe in the community. And his, and he was a banker besides. So he was able to put money where it did the most good.
No, he's not alive.
No, he died about a year or two ago.
Who are some of the people from those days you think would be important to interview? You know, some of the people maybe who were at those meetings, some of the philanthropists, some of the leaders.
Wow. You know, you forget names, and when you don't see people for, because I, you know, I didn't socialize with a lot of these people.
Yeah.
And the gentleman that was the president of, the head of Sikorsky, they had a big involvement in Bridgeport. You had the...
And he's still around.
Well, Igor Sikorsky died a few years ago, but and I don't know where this guy is now. I think he died, to be honest with you. But you had, as I indicated, Father McGinnis, who's now, he's up at Boston College, and Hawley, the two Hawleys, actually, and... the president of the University of Bridgeport. You had people in education that you were concerned that the kids were getting a good education, and I think that's constantly a problem. I think school attendance is a problem. I don't know what they do about it today. In your day, in my day, we had truant officers who might go and ring your doorbell and say, "You're not in school, I'll come." You know? But the structure of Bridgeport in those days, it was an industrial community. So it was important to get input, I think, from the industrial leadership as well as the banking community. I think that the industry is born, and somehow, somewhere, Bridgeport has got to find a new tax base.
Did you know Igor Sikorsky?
I had met him a couple of times, two or three times. He was, I think, a very interesting guy. If you looked at him, you would say, this guy is not a genius. You know? But he was, and there's pictures of him in the Bridgeport's archives of at the Bridgeport Airport with something that looks like it came out of Rube Goldberg, and the guy's holding it down, and he's got his felt hat on, and he's maneuvering this helicopter up and down. It's you know, it's the beginning of the industry. He came here to Stratford, actually, from Long Island. He was a white Russian out of Russia, and he was building the flying boats that Sikorsky was making in those days. And in World War II, they used them for anti-submarine patrol. But he got into the helicopter, and that just, you know, it's what it is today. Now they just built, I think they just either have put an addition or they built a new plant in the south end of Bridgeport to develop one of its new helicopters, I think the Apache helicopter.
Uh-huh.
But it needs something, Bridgeport needs a spark. It needs a dynamic mayor, and it needs leadership, and it needs a tax base.
How about some of the labor leaders? Anybody who stands out?
Yeah, John Driscoll. Mm-hmm. John Driscoll was the head of the whole state of Connecticut. John was married to Margaret Driscoll, who was a judge. Margaret was a very feisty woman. John was not the average labor leader. You know, you think of the average labor leader as some steel worker. worker who came up through the ranks, that sort of thing. But John was a very brilliant guy, an educated guy, smart. And the labor loved him. He was their leader. There was no question about it. John wouldn't hesitate to pick up the phone and call you, because he knew I'd call back anyway, or to talk to him anyway. Margaret wouldn't hesitate to call up and argue with you. But she was a very bright girl too. The two of them were brilliant people. They were staunch Democrats and hard workers.
What would she argue with you about, Margaret?
Well, she might argue that something I'm doing is not right. I shouldn't be doing it. And she would tell me.
Can you give me an example?
Offhand, I can't. I just recollect the fact that she would call me up and she'd say, "Huey, what are you doing?" And I say, "What do you mean, Margaret?" And then she'd go on and on, and I'd say, "You're crazy," or something like that. But we were good friends until the day she died. And John, I always had a high admiration for him. I thought he was he would talk things, or he wasn't as feisty as Margaret, but he'd sit down and tell you his own point of view. He wouldn't agree with you just because you're a Democrat. He'd tell you what he thought and what ought to happen and what should happen. And he was, I think that the labor movement in Bridgeport accepted him completely as their leader.
Anybody else, labor, you dealt with?
Well, the guy that was the labor leader for most of the city employees with a guy by the name of Hank Kirshner. And he and I got along great, although we had arguments. I remember telling him that they could march around City Hall till he was down to his knees, and I wasn't going to give him a 20-year retirement plan. But he was a smart negotiator. He'd take what he got, and then he'd be back the next year for what he didn't get, you know. He's dead now, but he was, I think, did a great job for all the municipal employees. So.
You know, you talk about the image problem, and I guess part of the image used to be organized crime in Bridgeport.
Well, I don't know. You know, there's organized crime in every major city. There was in those days. I don't think that they had that much influence on anybody, really. Who, or where, or what, or why, I just don't think so.
So there wasn't a problem when you were mayor?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, there were people that I knew were organized crime people. You would know it. I would know it. They had no influence on the local government, and the problem was the law enforcement people had a job to do, and they tried to do it.
Frank Piccolo, he was one.
I had met Frank Piccolo, he used to belong over here to Mill River Country Club, and I can remember telling guys over there, you know, I come over here to play golf with you guys, and I see people, you know, they're treating him like he's the king. I says, he's nothing but a two-bit hood, and I don't understand it. And he was eventually got murdered.
Shot in the phone booth, I think.
Yeah. Up on the North Main Street in Bridgeport. I don't think they ever found the guy that shot him, if my recollection serves me right.
So when you said Martin Luther King had an influence on some white people too, what did you think of him?
Martin Luther King?
Uh-huh.
I thought he was a dynamic person, and he was the person for the age. He came along at the right time. He had the charisma that was necessary. He had the people that were following him. A lot of them were religious leaders and were the leaders in the black community. I think he was the man for his time.
And do you miss politics?
Sometimes I do. I have a friend of mine who calls me once in a while, and we kick it around. But I think that it's time for somebody that's younger and more active and is willing to devote the time.
And
this fellow is running for mayor in Bridgeport now. I had never met him. I met him at Sam Tedesco's funeral. I was impressed by him. And what I've seen in the past month, I think he's grown in the job. They tell me that the fellow is running against him, a Puerto Rican fellow. Everybody says he's a real nice guy. What's going to happen? Who knows?
Well, we can leave it at that.
Huh?
Leave it at that.